When you need mealtime inspiration, it's worth shopping Kroger, where you'll find over 30,000 mouthwatering choices that excite your inner foodie. And no matter what tasty choice you make, you'll enjoy our everyday low prices, plus extra ways to save, like digital coupons worth over $600 each week. You can also save up to $1 off per gallon at the pump with fuel points. More savings and more inspiring flavors make shopping Kroger worth it every time. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Fuel restrictions apply.
And here we go. Alberto Caballero, welcome back to the program.
Hello. Thank you very much for having me again here. It's a pleasure.
Now, Alberto, you've written two recent papers, and both of them very much piqued my interest. And the first was on a candidate star for the WoW signal, a source. Now, the WoW signal is vexing because and problematic because the Big Ear radio telescope had two feed horns. And that meant that there are two strips of the sky that the signal could have originated from. And you were able to find a star based on being sun-like that might be a good SETI target to search for a recurrence of the signal. Could you give us an overview of how you did that search and what data you used?
Yeah, sure. Well, basically, I used a database called Gaia Archive, which belongs to the European Space Agency. Basically, it's a catalog of, containing thousands of stars. You can actually search the stars by the temperature, luminosity, radius, and many parameters. And you actually can see which of those stars are like the sun, which of them are red dwarfs, K-type stars. Well, there is a different variety of stars in that database. The database actually only shows you 2,000 stars in every single search. And for example, in the WoW signal region, there are more than 2,000 stars. I calculated around more than 6,000. So, 6,000 in the two beams of the radio telescope. There are two regions of the WoW signal region, and in total, more than 6,000 stars. So I try to focus on those stars, mainly G and K type stars, which could be more similar to the sun. Yes.
Now the candidate star is very sun-like, right? So could you give us a comparison between it and the sun, and how are they different, or how are they the same?
Well, I would say that they are pretty. I mean, well, the data has some. In error of interval and some interval of error. We don't know 100% sure whether or not that the star is a sun-like star. We need actually more data about, for example, the metallicity of the star, which actually gives a glimpse of how many planets or the star could have, or any planets at all, because it is believed that the stars with low metallicity usually have a smaller number of planets orbiting around them, or even no planets at all. So the metallicity is quite an important parameter to know whether or not there are planets around that star, and we don't know that. We don't have that information. So there are some limitations. But yeah, the radius of that star is practically the same as the sun: radius, luminosity, temperature, and there is quite confusion in my paper with the media, etc., because they thought that I was only looking for sun-like stars, and not really. I was actually looking for any kind of G-type star, K-type star, which is a huge sample of data, and I only found one G2V star, which is an exactly type as the sun. So it's like within the G-type stars, there are many sub-categories. And I only found one exactly like the sun. We can call it a solar twin. But there are, of course, the sample of data that I took was huge. All G-type stars, K-type stars. I didn't look for red dwarfs because, many red dwarfs emit flares, which it is believed that this kind of flares would actually destroy the atmosphere of the exoplanets orbiting in the habitable zone. So and we don't really know which stars emit flares and which of them don't emit flares. So, but yeah, once we have the data, of course, we can actually also include those red dwarfs that don't emit flares. Yes.
Well, you have to start somewhere, because while the profile of red dwarfs lately has been getting better for habitability, in other words, they apparently flare at their nearer to their poles, and that would mean that they don't bathe their exoplanets in radiation. But that's just one paper, so we still don't completely know yet. But the flare stars are a problem for sure. And then, you know, the other problem is it's extraordinarily hard to look for exoplanets, particularly terrestrial ones, around type K, the orange dwarfs, because they're just right in this zone where it's just hard to observe that, you know, and look for transits and things like that. So you have to start somewhere. You have to start with the sun-like stars, the G-type stars, and go from there. And since this is really just a proposal to look at that star with a radio telescope and monitor it, then it accomplishes that. We at least have something, finally, from the wild signal to look at in a targeted SETI search, right?
Yes, exactly. And I believe that the most fascinating thing about this star, it's actually the distance at which it's located from our solar system, because it is located 1,800 light years away. And for example, as far as I'm concerned, the only research paper trying to see, trying to calculate the distance at which the closest civilization could be, it was written by McConney, which is a mathematical, SETI researcher. And he calculated that the closest civilization would likely be located 1,900 light years away. And the star I found is actually located 1,800. That's only a difference of 100 light years, which might sound like a lot, but when we are talking about galactic terms, 100 light years is like, you know, around the corner, really, really close. So the thing that fascinated more when I found this candidate is actually that, the distance. Of course, the McConney studio does not mean that for certain, we are sure that the closest civilization is likely to be at that distance. But well, it's more, you know, statistical data that actually overlaps and seems to be to coincide. Well, there seems to be a coincidence in both articles, which were done independently in the different years.
Yeah, the McConney paper is interesting because it does put an interesting constraint, I guess you would call it, on the distances, where we could expect the nearest alien civilization to be found. And as I recall, it was 500 light years. And that actually rings true to me, because I don't expect us to find anything within 100 light years because of just the statistical odds. But yet that's where we look, you know, in general. And I've always wondered, you know, is there a better way that we could search further stars, because the chances are greater, but it's also, you know, the case that it's also harder to see them. And, you know, you get things like the inverse square law in radio, where you don't have much hope of seeing them unless they're putting many, many, many terawatts or yottawatts into their signal. And that just doesn't seem like anybody would do that. Do you think, Alberto, that might be the solution to the Fermi paradox, is that all alien civilizations are over 500 light years away and very difficult to detect as a result?
Yes, it could be one of the answers, of course, because the distances are quite huge. We have been emitting radio signals to space quite powerful by our military radio or military radars. If there is a civilization out there, they actually need to have the technology to pick up those signals, and we actually have this technology for the last 80 years, less than 100 years. So it's quite recently the technology that we have when it comes to radars and radio telescopes, etc. So, the fact that we are not receiving anything might be just because they are too far, or just because they don't have the technology, but they can be, you know, intelligent species like us, 100 years ago. So yeah, I think it's quite complicated to answer that question. But yeah, I think the reason why I chose, I tried to make that paper and try to see if there was any interesting star, is to actually to search for exoplanets around that star, because which is, as you said, it's quite difficult because a G-type star, most of the stars, they don't orbit in front of us. Like we cannot use the transit method to discover exoplanets around most of the stars. So we have to rely on other methods like, radial velocity. And for radial velocity, when it comes to G-type stars, the bubble of the star is actually quite small. We need a really sensitive instruments to detect exoplanets around G-type stars. We now have Espresso, which is an instrument located in one of the biggest telescopes, optical telescopes in the world. And with that telescope, we are more or less able to detect planets like Earth around G-type stars located far away, no? But we started having this technology quite recently, like, I don't know, a couple of years ago. So now there is some hope that we will be able to discover a truly Earth-like planet quite even nearby. Who knows?
Well, we're getting close, especially with a very successful deployment of JWST, so we can start trying to at least try to spot them, and characterize atmospheres and things like that. So the capabilities are coming on, but it gets even better as time goes forward, because if we ever build LUVOIR, then we would really have a capability of characterizing terrestrial exoplanets. But our best shot right now, anyway, as far as seeing a civilization, is the radio telescope, and this is something we can do right now. We can, say they're reading your paper at the Allen Telescope Array. They're probably going to take a look, wouldn't you think?
Yeah, I think so. I actually, the other day, I came across one SETI Institute Twitter, talking about my paper, and I was thinking that's good news, because maybe they realize that my paper exists, so they can now. Well, I personally think that probably they have been scanning that part of the sky for quite a long period, but we're talking about many stars, so obviously, if you focus on specific stars, the chances of getting some signal from that particular star are going to be higher. And also there are many frequencies. So, maybe they didn't scan that part of the sky exactly, or that star, or, set of stars in all the frequencies. So I think it's always interesting to actually make a specific, quest on some sort of, on specific stars, not just one maybe, but a set of stars to see if there is something there. And also, SETI Institute has been scanning the sky with laser detectors lately to see if they could pick up any signal in this spectrum. Because, if you have a laser and you have a telescope lens, like a Fresnel lens, you can actually produce a much powerful signal, which is going to overcome the square inverse law, because you are using actually a Fresnel lens to focus, the beam of light at a specific point. Thought by an author, I don't remember his name, but he was thinking about focusing a beam of laser of light into a solar sail located, many light years away from Earth to propel a spacecraft. An extraterrestrial civilization could do the same, use a laser and a Fresnel lens to overcome the square inverse law. And the good thing about the laser beams is that, you don't have to check, you don't have to find the frequency of the radio signal. You can see the signal with your optical telescope, so it's much easier to detect. Yes.
Now, that brings up a question, Alberto. That we look, especially for the WOW signal, because it was near this frequency at 1420 megahertz. And I sort of wonder about that. Everybody calls it the water hole and that it would be an obvious place to search for alien signals. But that also means that if aliens are sending out signals, they may not do it at that frequency because they want to listen for other aliens. And everybody's listening to dead air because everybody leaves that frequency alone, which amazingly we do. We set that aside, in the 1970s, specifically for radio astronomy. The 1420 megahertz hydrogen line. And we did it globally. Nobody actually transmits on it, except clandestinely, perhaps. So do you think that that's viable, that we we're looking at the wrong frequency, and that, as you said, we should be looking at a very wide range of frequencies when we look at targeted SETI searches?
Yeah. Well, I think that that's true. I mean, most of the search has been, the SETI searches have been focusing on the hydrogen line because it is believed that it will be the frequency that an extraterrestrial civilization would use to contact us because, it's the most common element in the universe, which we still have to see. Right now we think it's the most common element, but our understanding of the universe is not quite 100% accurate or complete. Of course, as far as I'm concerned, the SETI Institute has been scanning the sky also in several frequencies between specifically 1 and 10 gigahertz. But we are talking about the same. There are more frequencies after the 10 gigahertz mark and also more frequencies below the 1 gigahertz. So they are focusing in a wider range of frequencies because it is believed that between 1 and 10, the environmental radio frequency noise is quite low. So for us, it's easier to pick up a signal between 1 and 10. It removes quite of the noise from, cosmic background noise and et cetera. So there are many more frequencies. There are millions of frequencies. So it's, for me, it's like searching for a radio signal in that huge, immense ocean of frequencies. It's like looking for a needle in a haystack. It's quite difficult. I mean, the whole SETI project and the SETI community, for me, it's fundamental. They do a really important job. For me, it's fundamental and very important. But it's like really difficult to find anything due to the millions of frequencies. So that's why I think it's important to try, and they are actually doing, to try to detect laser pulses, which could be much more similar. And on Earth, we actually use a laser to communicate between, use communication between satellites. So we are already using laser signals here in space.
Yes, and laser signals are going to get ever more important because if we start sending out, as you mentioned, light sails, that's the way to do it. That's the way to push them. It pays here to sort of dig into just how we look, in radio for alien signals. And to expand on what you were saying, when we look, we're looking for a narrowband signal because a narrowband signal tends to be technological. Nature emits very few narrowband signals. But if you're actually transmitting something, by doing it narrowband, it saves you energy. Broadband is very wasteful, whereas narrowband is very technological. So that's why we look. But the problem is that those signals can get hidden among the millions and millions of frequencies. So you have to be able to pick it out. And that was the thing with the WAF signal is that it was extremely narrowband. The way the Big Ear worked, the equipment, was that it basically cut just the frequency from 1420 megahertz and just slightly above it, and it chopped it into 10 channels and searched those channels. A lot of those 10 channels, which were very tiny, WAW only appears in one. And in fact, if it had been one channel lower, it wouldn't have seen it because it was outside of the range. Now, modern equipment can search millions of channels, but back then they only had those 10, and they were just searching around the hydrogen line, which that telescope was built for. It was built to study the hydrogen clouds in the Milky Way and map them. And once that was done, it became a SETI instrument looking at the, you know, near the hydrogen line for alien signals. And surprisingly, unlike most SETI experiments, it found one. It saw one, a very, very powerful one. Now, that's the other thing in regards to the candidate. Given that it's distant, that would mean the WOW signal was sent out at extremely high power. And if it was through a Fresnel lens, though, it may not be that high power, right?
Sorry, can you repeat this last question?
So imagine it like this. If you're at a distance of 500 light years or, you know, something like that, and you're using a Fresnel lens to focus your signal into a laser, basically, then you need a lot less energy to do that than you would if it was an omnidirectional beacon, right?
Yeah.
So in this case, you know, instead of, it's always been criticized that WOW was too powerful. You know, this thing was a 30 sigma detection. And that would mean that these aliens were putting, you know, like the entire power of their sun or something like that into this signal, but not really if you're focusing it. So you can get by with a lot less energy and still produce a powerful signal if you're pointing it straight at your target. So it seems likely that they, if they were actually sending the signal that way, they meant it for us, wouldn't you think?
Yes, of course. I mean, I think that we don't really know how much power, how much energy an extraterrestrial civilization would have. Maybe they have much more than us. For them, that amount of energy is quite normal, something that maybe for us would be like a huge consumption of energy. Like actually, we're trying to send, you know, there is the Starshot project that intends to send nanocrafts to Proxima B using an array of lasers using 100 gigawatts of power. And we are still don't have, you know, we are not able to reach that amount of energy for this specific use. But maybe, you know, for an extraterrestrial civilization, 100 gigawatts of power is the consumption of a single family. Who knows, no? But yeah, of course, I agree. It's that aspect. Also, the other aspect that makes the signal to be, well, questionable is that it was not modulated. It was just a signal, a beam of energy without any message in it. So we don't know. I mean, if there was actually an extraterrestrial message, it would probably modulate it because they would be sending, you know, a message like the ones we have sent, like humanity have sent to another planet with a message on it. And this one, but also on the other side, it was not modulated, but we were only able to pick it up for 72 seconds. So maybe those 72 seconds, you know, were not modulated but the rest of the message that we missed and we didn't pick up, maybe the rest of the message was actually modulated. So who knows, no? But I think the most interesting thing about the WOW signal is that that it never repeated, because actually the same thing that makes it to be unlikely of extraterrestrial origin, in my opinion, is an important point, because we have never received such a weird signal. It's not like, for example, fast radio bursts, which are actually 10,000 fast radio bursts in the sky every single day, and we don't know what they are. Quite good, but there are many. But the WOW signal, we haven't, as far as I'm concerned, we have not received any signal like that at all. So, in my opinion, that makes that signal pretty weird. It could be said that the fact that the signal did not repeat means that it was a natural event, but actually the signals we have sent to other potentially habitable planets, our own signals did not repeat or last for a long period of time either. So, and actually we have not sent any radio signal in the hydrogen line, using the hydrogen line, as far as I'm concerned. So, it could actually be anything.
Yeah, well, that's just it. I mean, take the Arecibo signal, you know, the one very powerful signal we sent out. The frequency that we did that at was set by the intent of the radar that it actually was. You know, it was designed to radar asteroids. And we sent out that signal at the frequency we did because that's what the equipment could do. We did not send it at the hydrogen line. So it was very ad hoc. So if you if you apply that to aliens, then it's not surprising that we wouldn't see them, because they're very, very transient, just like we are. But you do have some hope, things like radar, maybe, you know, very powerful signals. But interestingly, those signals contain no message. Just like, wow, there's nothing there. There's no modulation, or at least not modulation that you would use to communicate something. So it's entirely possible that we're seeing signals, but we just don't have enough to go on to recognize them.
That's true. I mean,
you know, it could be that we're seeing aliens every day, you know, near the hydrogen line, but the communications are just so obscure that we don't know that that's what that is, you know, because transient signals do come in still, you know, nothing quite like wow, but they still come in, but they get discarded. So do you think that there's a high probability that we might have actually detected aliens and just missed it?
Yeah, I think that's perfectly possible, because we don't really know the language of an extraterrestrial civilization. So maybe those you know, signals were encoded in a language that we don't really understand. So we use the binary code, ones and zeros, to send a message with one and zero, that composition. But you know, maybe they are using other form to communicate with us, or to communicate, you know, to send interstellar messages. Maybe they don't use the binary code. So yeah, maybe we don't understand the language that they are using. And yeah, basically that. Yeah.
Well, we also don't know about timeframes and repetition. So an alien civilization that wanted to contact us might say, well, we're going to send them a message periodically, and that period is going to be once every 400 years, because that's how long they operate, you know, their time frames.
Yeah.
And that's a total unknown, because it's completely unpredictable. You don't know what time intervals an alien would choose to contact you. So that, you know, us fast humans, you know, that only live for 80 years or whatever, we're just too impatient to look long enough to see the pattern, you know? So that's why people don't realize just how hard SETI searches are.
Yeah.
Because, and it shouldn't be surprising that nothing's been seen yet. And I wouldn't want to say, based on the corpus of information that we've built over the last 50 years, we got a lot more looking to do before we can say anything. You know, people like to say, well, there are no aliens, or else you'd have seen a radio signal by now. Well, that's not true. Come back and talk to me in about 500 or 600 years. Then we might be able to say that.
Yeah.
Do you agree?
Yes, of course. I mean, the time frames of an extraterrestrial civilization could be totally different than ours. So, yeah, the fact that, again, maybe they might not be actually sending any message, for the same reason that we are not sending any message, because we are kind of afraid of, you know, of the possibility that a malicious civilization could pick up the signal. So actually, we have been emitting quite a small number of messages to outer space, I mean, to specific habitable planets, and using, you know, specific frequencies. But on the other hand, we have also some radars on the Earth. I think it's called EGLIN, the EGLIN U.S. Space Force radar, which actually emits radio signals with a power of 32 megawatts, which is quite a huge amount of power if we compare it, for example, with the WOW reply, which was sent in 2012 by the Arecibo Observatory, and it used only 1 megawatt. So we have actually been emitting radio signals much more powerful than the ones we use for interstellar communication. And those signals are written, or let's say encoded, in our own language, so which can be misunderstood by, you know, a natural event, because as you said, you know, of course, the ones we send for interstellar communication try to repeat in a temporal pattern, but the ones used for military communication, not necessarily. So they just contain messages of, well, secret content. So yeah, it's quite a huge, and that's why, yeah, I think laser would be the solution. Yes.
Now that brings us to your second recent paper, Malicious Aliens. And the idea that we could maybe estimate based on our own history the likelihood of coming across a malicious alien civilization. And if that likelihood is low, then we can start looking into things like METI and sending out much, much more comprehensive, coherent messages to try to make contact with an alien civilization. So the question everybody's going to have is, what'd you come up with? How likely is it that if we do run into an alien civilization, that it will be malicious and dangerous?
Yes, well, my research, well, first of all, I have to say two things. First of all, my research is quite speculative. It's a lot of speculation because, that on the one hand. And on the other hand, I have to say that when it comes to the Drake equation and trying to determine how many civilizations there are, in general, in space, it's quite speculative because there can be between zero and, you know, around 60,000, according to Makone. So it could be any number between those two numbers. So it's quite a speculation, the Drake equation and this research. They're trying to determine how many malicious civilizations could be out there. On the one hand, and on the other hand, we are talking about a sample of just one civilization. What I did in my research was to extrapolate the data that we know, and we only know about the life on one planet. So it's the sample you are using is just one. So that it's a huge limitation. Also, there is another limitation, which is we are thinking about the behavior of humanity, which might not be the same as the behavior of an extraterrestrial civilization due to a different composition of the brain. But so, yeah, what I did was actually, I came up with a really small probability, but that's largely based on the fact that there are many potentially habitable planets. We're talking about 40 billion potentially habitable planets, and the probability of existing complex life in any of them is quite low. So therefore, the probability of any of those complex life forms being malicious is also low. So in that regard, that's why it's quite low.
Yeah, I could see if the civilizations are biological and they're like us, not only is the probability low, there's also the distance. You know, it's asking a lot to say, we're going to travel 1,000 light years and attack that planet. That's asking a lot. And I think that everybody's basically going to conclude that there's plenty of real estate in the galaxy and you don't really need to engage in warfare of that expense. You know, I mean, it would be the most expensive thing a civilization could ever do would be to send a battle fleet somewhere to attack a planet. So I think the likelihood there is low. What worries me is the dividing line between biological and technological. So eventually, if you have a civilization that's a machine civilization, and Seth Shostak has actually made that bet that when we do pick up a signal, it's more likely that what's on the other end is a machine. That's where you could really get into an arch malicious civilization that's just has no interest or respect for biology and might come through your star system looking for raw materials and just not even acknowledge that you're there. It just takes you out. That's what worries me, is the difference between biology and technology.
Yeah,
because it's a total wild card. But with biology, I tend to agree with you that, you know, humans can do terrible things, but most of the time we don't, you know. So most of the time we're just, you know, going to work and you know, having lunch, things like that. So I tend to take some measure of comfort from that we're not all bad, you know, most of the time. Do you agree with that?
Yes, of course. What I did was to first of all to calculate the probability of how many invasions have taken place on Earth in the last 100 years, and then I extrapolated that to a Type 1 civilization based on how, you know, humanity would behave in the future once we become a Type 1 civilization, and of course right now actually the numbers came with a conclusion that us as humanity we are more dangerous than humanity in the future, based, you know, on that kind of extrapolation of the data. And I was thinking, yeah, of course, right now on the Earth, there is more or less 5% of the population of the Earth is psychopath. They have psychopathological behaviors. And you can say, of course, maybe, you know, an alien species in the brain composition of an extraterrestrial civilization is completely different than ours, and they have much less empathy, many more psychopathological behaviors. But if we take a look on those cases on Earth, we have psychopaths and this kind of people, and we can realize that these people struggle to survive. They have many problems. So for me, it's really difficult to see how this kind of people would evolve. And develop to if all the population were like that, like that 5% that we have on Earth, for me it's really difficult to see how they could develop to a much advanced civilization. If now on Earth they can barely, you know, integrate with not just integrate, but, you know, cooperation is fundamental, in my opinion, to the development of a civilization. And usually psychopaths are people that don't cooperate. They are selfish people. They want everything for themselves. So I don't see, you know, in terms of psychology, I don't see how they would be able to develop, because we have that sample. We can actually analyze and study the psychopaths here on Earth to understand how an intelligent species would actually behave if all of them were like that. No, but as you said, some, you know, extraterrestrial civilization could actually be robotic, and they might not be humanoids, or they might be just machines. But maybe, you know, in that sense, maybe, you know, I believe that those machines would have been built by some sort of, you know, intelligence like us. So here on Earth, for example, we are trying to, you know, well, not right now still, but the idea would be to, you know, to integrate the three laws to machines so they would not cause any harm. So at some point, I mean, the humanity would actually have some sort of control over the machines. But as you said, at some point in history, that control could be lost, and the machines could actually overtake the human control and start operating by themselves, and, you know, forget those few laws or whatever laws an extraterrestrial civilization would place over their machines. So yeah, any scenario would be possible, in my opinion. Yes.
And it's just so variable. It could go either way. You could end up with a machine that was originally programmed with ethics that is actually has zero psychopaths. In other words, the whole machine civilization, every machine entity within it is perfectly sane and they don't attack anybody. Or it could go the other way, and it's 100% what we would define as psychopathic, because being self-centered and all of those things that go with that is very good for survival in a universe that has finite resources. So it's interesting and scary to speculate about, but fun nonetheless. However, that you could actually put a number on it was interesting. And I think it overall tells us that it's probably not that dangerous that we're visible, you know, that anybody could, you know, within sufficient distance of us could see us right now with what we're, you know, producing, which is, you know, that probability is low, actually. It's not that bad because, number one, there's probably not an alien civilization close by. And number two, they probably are not going to travel the great distances to do anything to us. So it's probably safe in this case to actually message and actively try to contact alien civilizations. Don't you think?
Yeah, I actually came up with specific numbers. If we are talking, for example, about, my paper was actually focused on trying to see the likelihood of invasion or the likelihood of finding a malicious civilization among those planets that we send a message to, because otherwise it's quite difficult that, you know, even if considering that, yeah, we have military radars, quite powerful, but still the distances are quite large, and they might not have the technology to pick up the signals. But yeah, it was more, you know, I was specifically trying to see, we are actually emitting quite powerful radio signals by our military radars. And we are having actually been emitting radio signals, sending radio signals to specific potentially habitable planets. What is the likelihood that the specific planets we send a message to contain or host a malicious civilization? And it was quite low. It was actually, the probability. There are two numbers. Lately in the media, they have been talking about four civilizations. So there will be four malicious civilizations in the Milky Way. But that number comes from the fact, from the hypothesis that all civilizations would be like us, like humanity. So, which is something that we don't know whether there are any civilizations at all. We don't know whether they are more advanced, less advanced. So that's why it's a hypothetical case. If all of them were like us, there would be around four, based on, you know, as I said, on all the invasions that have happened on Earth in the last 100 years. But a civilization like us would actually not have the technology to travel to our planet. So they would not pose any threat theory because, there are four malicious like us, if all of them, were like us, but they would not have the technology to come to Earth. So they don't really pose any threat. And for the case of type one stars, which is actually considered that a type one civilization would be capable of nearby interstellar travel, the probability is even lower, goes down to 0.... even lower than that. In that case, there will be less than one malicious civilization, less than one type one malicious civilization, if all of them were type one. But again, there could be, you know, type two, type three, but that would be, the highest, estimation, because, you know, a type two and a type three civilization would actually be less likely to attack the Earth. So that's why I try to calculate the numbers for a type one, which would be the closest to our civilization in terms of, technological advancement. And also the one which is capable of traveling here, because otherwise, how can you attack? Well, there are possibilities, but again, you would need energy to launch an attack from another, from one solar system to another one. You would actually need a huge amount of energy and technology to launch, for example, a laser attack. No, so that's why, I came up with less than one. A type one civilization, malicious type one civilization in our galaxy. So yeah, the numbers are quite small. And actually, I compared the probabilities with the probability of the impact of an asteroid, just to make the public and the general public to see, to try to compare those probabilities, no? And actually, the probability, what the numbers I came up with, the probability of an extraterrestrial invasion is actually smaller than the probability of the Earth being hit by a huge asteroid that could actually end with a large number of the population on Earth.
It's worth noting here before we go that if there were a malicious Type 3 civilization in the Milky Way, we wouldn't be here. we would probably have never evolved. They would have taken this world and turned it into a Borg home world or something like that. And that the likelihoods again are just, we see no evidence that anybody's ever been here, you know? So it just seems low because the distances are too great. Now everybody should check out Alberto's YouTube channel, the Exoplanets channel. And Alberto, there'll also be links to the two papers in the description below. And thanks again for joining us today, Alberto. And I hope you'll come and check in with us again next time you release the next paper.
Thank you. Thank you very much for the invitation. It was a pleasure.